From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Have you ever grown a carnivorous plant? A Venus flytrap or sundew or pitcher plant, perhaps? I bet even a lot of keen gardeners haven't. Today's guest is going to encourage us to change that and maybe as a start, adopt one that you can cultivate on your windowsill even. All in time for International Carnivorous Plant Day on Wednesday, May 4th, we're also going to learn about the plight of carnivorous plants in the wild, where they're disproportionately endangered. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, small gift books illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now. Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Today we're talking carnivorous plants, and my guest Kenny Coogan is a board member and education director for the International Carnivorous Plant Society. Kenny's also author of the recent book Florida's Carnivorous Plants, and he operates a carnivorous plant nursery in Florida. Hi, Kenny, how are you?
I am doing great. Thank you, Margaret, for having me on.
Yeah, how are all your hungry little plants down
there? They're doing well.
Good.
They're eating often.
Yes, good, good. Well fed. So before we get started, I want to say we're going to have a book giveaway of your book, which is fascinating. Florida's Carnivorous Plants, with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. So I think you used to live up north, Kenny, and even founded maybe a carnivorous plant club somewhere in New York State and then moved to Florida. And I keep wondering, is it a coincidence that you moved to the state that has dozens of native species of carnivorous plants? I think more than any in the U.S. or
Yeah, that's a good point. But I did not move for that reason. I mostly moved for the weather and job opportunities.
Uh-huh. But it was serendipity.
Exactly. And then I said, oh, it's even easier to grow carnivorous plants down here.
I think I've read like that it has, as I said, I think the most, does it have the most species in the country or something? I mean, it's quite a diversity in Florida.
Yeah, we have over 30 species of carnivorous plants.
Wow. 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 So we'll talk more about that. And before we dig into the plants, Wednesday, May 4th, World Carnivorous Plant Day. So tell us a little bit about why this celebration is taking place and what it is.
Sure. This is the second annual World Carnivorous Plant Day. It was brought to our attention by a member in Poland that we should offer a day where everyone can celebrate carnivorous plants. A lot of times when I do presentations, I'll ask the audience to name a carnivorous plant and they can get the Venus flytrap and maybe they can get a pitcher plant. And then I say, okay, well, we only got about 998 more to go.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, carnivorous plants are found on all six continents. They are microscopic to pretty large. They serve lots of different purposes in the different environments. And unfortunately, many of them, well, proportionally, they are more endangered than non-carnivorous plants.
Ah.
Because they really like pure ecosystems. And people like growing them. So we thought it would be a great day to have a celebration where we have conservationists, growers, scientists, educators, authors. We all get together and we can celebrate these wonderful plants.
And you get together virtually, literally around the world, don't you? I mean, it's kind of...
Yeah, so this is the second year. And last year, my idea was every hour on the hour, for 24 hours, I would release a video, and most of the videos are between 10 and 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I'm in Florida. So at midnight my time, I start releasing the Japanese and the Australian videos, and then I just work around the world.
That's great. And they're on a YouTube channel. And again, we'll give links to all these good things, how people can learn more and participate and so forth. So you've been a middle school science teacher, I believe, until recently, right? I mean, that was what you were doing full time until recently. Yes.
Science. Yes.
Yes. Yep. So pretend we're students with about that level of knowledge. And because, again, even kindergartners, I don't think really know that much for the most part. Probably 9 out of 10 at least don't know that much about carnivorous plants. So just tell us, you hinted a little bit about it in your introduction about the event, but tell us like the not too complicated version of what a carnivorous plant is, you know, versus non-carnivorous. Like what is it?
Yeah. So when, unfortunately, there really isn't a scientific line of what is carnivorous, what's non-carnivorous. What usually happens is if a scientist wants to publish something and say that it's carnivorous, they can kind of work their way into it. But generally speaking, we say that a carnivorous plant has to lure their prey. They have to be able to digest their prey, and they have to be able to benefit from their prey. So some carnivorous plants, some non-carnivorous plants, they might be able to kill an insect. Like if you think of plants that have thorns or digestive enzymes or, you know, sap that could be toxic to insects, but we don't consider them carnivorous because they might not be benefiting from the death of the animal. So we like to say that carnivorous plants are on the offense rather than the defense.
Okay. Oh, so it's not just that they have anti-predation sort of either chemistry or physical devices like those thorns you mentioned. It's that they benefit, that they enjoy it. they feast on it.
Yeah, and that's where the scientists can get a little vague because like how can we say that they benefit from it? I guess we can count, you know, how much seeds and offspring they produce, but maybe another scientist has a different definition of how they benefit from eating their organisms.
Right.
So right now we say there's about 1,000 species of carnivorous plants. Just in the past 40 or 50 years, 3 bromeliads have been classified as carnivorous.
Oh.
But as you can imagine, there's probably going to be other groups and even more bromeliads that are going to be classified as carnivorous as, you know, there's more research going on.
Okay. So the ones that we can grow, I know you're going to suggest that we can even maybe get to know them, if not in our gardens right away, we can get to know them on a windowsill, in a pot, in a container or something. And there are sort of, and probably through your nursery, you probably have people order some, I imagine, that you, or ask you about. Or at trade shows that you do, you know, where you do plant sales and so forth, ask you which are my sort of gateway carnivorous plants. Which do I? So where do we begin? Because I mean, they're fascinating looking, and the intricacy, their structures, you know, they're very different from a lot of the plants we grow in our gardens. And I was curious.
Sure. So there's over 20 genera of carnivorous plants, and we can keep lots of them in our windowsills or in our backyard. And they are from all the, you know, 6 continents except for Antarctica. So chances are that you will be able to find a carnivorous plant that grows in your area or in your house. And unlike non-carnivorous plants, carnivorous plants generally like a lot of light. And all carnivorous plants really need pure water. So that means they need distilled water or rain water. And if you have a water meter, they need about 50 parts per million or less of total dissolved solid. So in my city water is almost like 400 parts per million. So that's way too much for a carnivorous plant. And because I have thousands of carnivorous plants, I have 6 50-gallon rain barrels that I collect the rainwater. And that's usually between 0 and about 5 parts per million. So that's perfect.
Wow.
And then unlike most household plants, carnivorous plants usually want to be more damp, or they want to be even sitting in water. So those are like some things to consider. So for a Venus flytrap, which is the most infamous, they need a lot of light. So if you want to try to grow them inside, an easy solution is to give them a grow light that's 10 or 12 inches above the plant, or even a fluorescent bulb
right.
that's on for about 12 or 14 hours a day is usually sufficient amount of light. And they want to be sitting in about an eighth or a quarter inch of water all the time because they're from the Carolinas. They're from these swampy areas. So you never let a you never want to let a Venus flytrap dry out.
Right. Now, they're in the genus. I never know how to pronounce some of these. Dionea, is that how you say it? I don't know how you say it. How do you say it?
Yeah.
Venus flytraps.
Dionea.
Dionea. Okay. Yeah.
So that's the genus. And then the species name is Muscipula, which means mouse trap.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Then the governor of North Carolina named it like Venus's or Diane's mouse trap. But the common name is fly trap because he saw a fly get trapped. But then recently we found out that in the wild, they mostly eat spiders and crawling insects and not flying insects.
Oh, well, spider trap doesn't sound quite as good.
Yeah.
No. They are native. There is a population of these, a large population of these, that are native to our southeast. Where are they in nature, this plant?
Historically, they're from a 60-kilometer radius from Wilmington, North Carolina. And maybe 40, 50 years ago, there was a lot of poaching, so the population did go down. And maybe in the past 5 or 10 years, it's become a federal law to poach them, and you can get a $10,000 fine and years in jail if you poach them. The good news is people are not poaching them because it's much easier to propagate them through tissue culture. It's easier and it's cheaper to propagate, you know, hundreds and thousands of them through tissue culture and breeding. So people aren't wild collecting them anymore. And another reason why they're not doing it is because it's hard to find them in the wild. And also about 40 years ago, somebody sowed some Venus flytraps in the panhandle of Florida. And that population is still there, but we do not consider them native to Florida because they were introduced.
I see. Okay. So really it was just in that one area, huh?
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I think what's really amazing is their snap trap, you know, how they can close so quickly. But there is another carnivorous plant that also has a snap trap. And that the scientific name is Aldrovanda. The common name is waterwheel. And they're found throughout the world. But they're fully aquatic and they're eating little microscopic organisms.
Okay. So who else can go on our, this is one, the Venus flytrap is one that we're going to put on our, we can put on our windowsill. It has to be in a saucer or whatever of water.
Yep.
It's got to have good light.
Usually a window probably will not provide enough light. So
right.
It just needs a little extra supplemental light and a fluorescent bulb is good enough.
Okay. And
another group of carnivorous plants that are good for a windowsill are many subtropical and tropical species of sundews. And these look like little octopus. Two species that are really good for a windowsill are Drosera spatulata, which has these little spoon leaf shapes for their leaves.
Yes.
And then another one that's probably advertised more easily or more common is Drosera capensis, which is the Cape sundew of South Africa.
Oh, yes.
And that one gets maybe 10 or 12 inches long. And both of them eat fruit flies and fungus gnats. And people love to purchase them when I'm selling the, you know, I have a wide selection, but when people see that they eat fruit flies and fungus gnats, and when I say see it, I mean, there's actually little bugs stuck to the plants. People get really excited about the idea of, you know, wiping out all of their banana bug problems.
Yeah. I mean, that would be, I mean, for those of us with houseplants, especially if we're growing them in like a potting medium like that is peatin and so forth, and it's a little moist sometimes, you can get fungus, you can get an outbreak of fungus gnats. So,
yeah. So the sundews and then also Mexican butterworts, and their scientific name is Pinguicula, all of those will eat the white fly and fungus gnats and fruit flies. They'll eat a lot of them. And even if you have an army of these carnivorous plants, they're not going to take care of all of your pest problems, but they will help mitigate them a little bit.
Huh. Interesting. And light wise, how's that?
The sundews do good with a bright sunny window.
Oh.
They probably do not need supplemental lighting. And then the Mexican pinguiculas, the butterworts, they're about the same. The more light you give carnivorous plants, generally speaking, the brighter they become. So like some Mexican butterworts, they'll go from green to pink and purple, and then the sundews go from green to red. And the more sun, the dewier they get, which attract, you know, they produce more of their digestive enzymes, which attracts even more bugs. So usually 6 to 8 hours of lighting is okay. Sufficient.
So now that you said the dewiness, so that sort of glistening aspect, that's functional. that helps them to do the trapping. Is that the idea? Is that?
Yep. So the bugs are attracted to it, and then it's very sticky. Scientists are really interested in it because the stickiness is not soluble in water. So they're trying to figure out how they can make glue, you know, that we can use underwater. Based off of the sundews and the butterworts.
Interesting. Oh, huh. I didn't know that. And they are so intricate looking. When you look at them closely, they're just crazy looking.
Yeah.
So with these so far, I mean, are those in a saucer of water, or what about the rest of the habitat, so to speak?
Yeah, the sundews do good with a little saucer of water underneath them. I always keep them damp to wet. Okay. Some people have even experimented. If you're a beginner, I wouldn't do this, but people have even experimented having the Cape sundew Dracerica pentis underwater, like under 5 inches of water.
Oh.
And they'll live for a couple of months like that.
Huh. These probably don't come when they come by mail. They probably don't come in a pot or with the saucer or with the medium or whatever. I mean, what would I need to be ready to receive such?
Yeah. So for the darlings, plants that I've mentioned, I would do half peat and half perlite.
Okay.
You could also do all long fiber sphagnum.
Huh.
The fly traps may or may not be potted when you order them. The sundews usually are potted, and then there's a piece of plastic over the soil medium. So, because you don't want the plant to be covered in the medium because it's so sticky, it just grabs a hold of anything.
Yes, it would just be a mess. Right.
But because most of the sundews have these tiny little roots, most nurseries ship them in their pots.
Oh, I see. Okay. So some may come bare roots, so to speak, and some other types may come potted. Okay.
Yeah. A lot of nurseries also offer like, an extra $4, we'll send you it in the pot.
Okay. But so far the medium for those would be half peat and perlite, or to use the sphagnum, the longer sphagnum. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And then another potential for a windowsill are the Asian pitcher plants, which are the Nepenthes.
Oh, yes.
Which are often seen in hanging baskets. And while Nepenthes would probably prefer a more humid environment, they will adapt to a lower humidity in your windowsill or in a kitchen or in a bathroom. When growers sell Nepenthes, they usually divide them into two groups. There's the highlanders and the lowlanders. So the Nepenthe species that are from the top of the mountain, they're called the highlanders. And then the ones that are on sea level are called the lowlanders. So if your conditions are more like the top of a mountain, which is around like 50 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, pretty humid, pretty bright indirect light, then maybe a highlander would be good for you. Where in Florida, if your temperatures are more like 80 to 90, you know, during the day and night, really high humidity, high temperatures, then lowlanders would be good choice. Or if you're kind of in the middle, You could also look for species or hybrids that are intermediate. So a lot of breeders are breeding plants from the top of the mountain to the ones at the bottom of the mountain. And now these plants are good for 45 to 90 degrees. They're good a range of humidity. They look super cool. You know, they have different shapes and colors on the pitchers.
Huh. So this is the Nepenthes, the Asian ones, the Asian pitchers.
Yeah.
And is Sarracenia the one of our native species, genus? Of pitcher plants.
Yeah.
How do they compare visually, the Nepenthes versus the Sarracenias?
The Nepenthes turn into 6 to 15 or even longer foot vines.
Oh.
And then the pitchers, depending on the species, some of them can only be a couple inches. Some of them can be as large as, some of them can hold like a liter of water and digest a rat. The Sarracenia, which are the native North American pitcher plants, they can be 3 or 4 inches up to 3 foot high. And these are the tubes that come up from the ground.
Right.
Whereas the Nepenthes are vines.
Oh, I see. Okay. Oh, so very different, huh? So that's why hanging basket, you said.
Yeah.
Works. Oh, interesting. And now, you know, a lot of times I'm up in the north, obviously, quite a different environment from yours and, you know, with a long winter. But in the, you know, May to September, October, I take most of my houseplants outside. Now, could I, if I had these types of, quote, houseplants, could I put them out in maybe not a baking hot location, but could I put them out? Where would I put them if I were to let them enjoy the summer outdoors? Or isn't that a good idea?
No, it's fine. So the Venus flytraps, the Sarracenia, and the sundews that I mentioned, and the Mexican butterworts, all of them would do good in full summer sun.
Oh, okay. But and with that water beneath them.
Yeah, they still want to be sitting in a little bit of water.
Okay.
And then the Asian pitcher plant, the Nepenthes, they want to be grown more like an orchid in bright indirect sun.
Okay.
So a little shadier.
Okay. Huh. So those are some of the good ones for sort of getting started indoors, do you think?
Yeah. So those are good beginner plants, and they're good for beginners because they're easily available and their conditions are pretty similar to what, you know, non-carnivorous houseplant growers are used to.
Okay. So, and we'll give some resources, I think, besides we both have for a long time known California Carnivores, for instance, out on the West Coast, which is a mail order source as well. So we'll give that with the transcript too, if people are interested. I think it's good to buy from people with expertise with these plants, not, do you know what I mean? Because you see all these places, they're being sold everywhere, but.
Yeah, so when I'm at the plant sales every weekend, quite a few people will walk by and say like, oh, I already, well, first off, they'll either say, oh, I kill them.
Right.
And then I tell them, oh, I could probably teach you how to keep them alive.
Right.
And as soon as I tell them that city water and well water kills them within about a month, then they always say like, oh yeah, that was my problem.
Okay. So that's one of the things. So maybe in these last couple of minutes, any other sort of basic rules on how to care for? So the water thing is really, the water source is really important.
Yeah. So they want to have clean water. Usually they want to be wetter than normal house plants.
Right.
And they do not want, if we're talking about for beginner advice, they do not want to be fertilized.
Okay. So
Miracle-Gro, soil that has fertilizer in it. You don't want to be adding extra nutrients because where they're from, generally speaking, you know, there's over 1,000 species, but generally speaking, they're from habitats that are moving minerals and contaminants from the soil away from their roots. So they're just not adapted to be able to withstand high concentrations of chlorine, fluoride, minerals, salts. So another thing is most carnivorous plants would prefer to be grown in a glaze pot or a plastic pot.
Yes.
So the only one that I would really avoid are terracotta pots because they're too salty.
Oh, they're salty. Okay. The other two that you mentioned also hold water a little, keep moisture in a little better, I think, than terracotta. Yeah. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, Kenny Coogan, I want to go to the local nursery and see what they have. But May 4th, Wednesday, May 4th, International Carnivorous Plant Day. We'll give more information about that. We're going to have a book giveaway with a transcript also on your recent book, Florida's Carnivorous Plants. And it's great to speak to you. And yeah, it was snowing up here yesterday, so you're smart to be in Florida. Thank you for making time today.
Thank you, Margaret.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too, I hope. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. And on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.